There's so many topics in this Torah portion to look at. As a matter of trying to choose, do we talk about the sota, the woman whose husband becomes jealous of her and suspect of her? Do we talk about the Aaronic blessing which is found in this portion, or the Nazarite? Or do we talk about that fascinating chapter there at chapter 7 where it repeats the same thing 12 times? This long chapter of, what, 80-some verses, 80, 90 verses or so. But I just feel impressed to talk about the three families of the Levites, and what their tasks were. At the end of chapter 4, I'm sorry, at the end of chapter 3, we are given account of the three families of Levi, the Gershonites, the Kohathites, and the Merarites, the family of Merari. Levi had these three sons, and these are the descendants of his three sons. And we're given a count. In Gershon, there were 7,500 from a month old and upward. Kohath had 8,600 from a month old and upward. These are men. And Merari, 6,200 males from 1 month on up. And these were counted for the sake of redemption. Since at Passover in Egypt, the firstborn of Israel were spared, they belong to God. What God redeems, God owns. If you're redeemed, He owns you. You've been bought with a price. The firstborn of Egypt's cattle and of their firstborn of their families died. But the firstborn of Israel's cattle and families, that they were spared because of the blood of the Lamb. So God says, since I redeemed these firstborn, they are mine. The firstborn of your cattle, you sacrificed to me. The firstborn of your sons are mine. And up to that time, the firstborn son was considered the priest of the home. But God says, but what I'm going to do is this. In place of the firstborn of every family, I am going to take the males of Levi, and the tribe of Levi becomes mine. So he had to count up the number of the Levite males and compare them to the number of males of the firstborn of Israel to make sure there's one to one, and there wasn't. There were a few more firstborn Israelites than there were male Levites. And so they had to bring some silver coins for the redemption of the others. But then we come to another count in chapter 4 of the three families of Levi. But this count is from those 30 years old up to 50 years old, from 30 to 50. Because now they're counting them for the work that they're given to do. And each of the Levitical families was given a particular task. And last week I hinted at there are spiritual insights into this, and I thought, well, we probably won't get to it till next time we go through the Torah, but we're going to look at it this week as it does run over into this week's portion. As you go through and read the descriptions in chapter 4, verses 21 to 28, it speaks of Gershon. And Gershon, his name means a stranger there. His name is Gershom, Moses' son. Gershon means a stranger there. And his job was to carry the curtains and the screens. You know, there are these veils that went all the way around the outer court. Sometimes they're referred to as lace. You could almost see through them. And the curtains and the screens are a picture of this flesh. It defines what is the tabernacle courtyard and what is outside the tabernacle courtyard. We are tabernacles, aren't we? On our flesh is not that tough. I know when you're a young man and you're working out and you're in sports, I'm invincible. You're not. You're really not. You'll get sick and you will age and get bruised and cut and beat up. I've been building a deck this week. I've got a nail went through my foot and I smashed my finger and I got bruises up down my arms. You know, it just doesn't last. Our bodies are like a spider's web. We're that fragile. We're like a moth-eaten cloth. We're like a vapor. It's here and then it's gone. That's what your physical bodies are like. Don't invest in the physical. Don't put all your investment into that. It does not pay great dividends. So the curtains and the screens represent the physical. And Gershom, a stranger there, His job, all the descendants of Gershom, from 20 years, or from 30 years to 50 years, their job was to carry the curtains, roll them up, fold them, whatever needed to be done, organize them, and then with the tabernacle set up, to put them all in the right place. In chapter 4, in the first 20 verses, though, we find Kohath. Kohath means called out. Called out. Their job was the Ark of the Covenant, and the veil that separated the Holy of Holies and the holy place was put over the Ark. Their job was to carry the menorah and all of its utensils, and the table of showbread and all of its utensils, and the golden incense altar and all of its utensils. The contents of the holy place and the Holy of Holies were the responsibility of Kohath, the called out ones. And then the third family of Levi, they're described in chapter 4, verses 29 to 37. Merari comes from the word mara, which means bitter. Remember Naomi. We read the book of Ruth last week. Naomi, her name means pleasant. And when she came home after she lost her husband and her two sons, and so she comes back empty-handed. All she has is this Moabite daughter-in-law, Ruth. And when she came home to Bethlehem, all the women come around and say, Naomi, you know, and she says, don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara, for God has dealt bitterly with me. And Miriam comes from this word. Miriam means bitter. And when they came to the waters of Mara, when they were going through the wilderness, they came to the waters that were bitter, and they cast the tree in, and it became sweet. Mara means bitter. Merari means bitter. Their job was the pillars of the courtyard and the silver sockets that they sat in. This is the part of the tabernacle that fully comes into contact with the earth. And so their job is to carry all these pillars and the sockets. So when the tabernacle arrived at the place and the column of fire or the cloud stopped, then what they do, they would park the Holy of Holies, they would build the pillars and the sockets around that, and around the holy place. They would install the contents there, and then the Mararites would come and put the pillars up where they belong, and then the Gershonites would come and stretch the curtains up, and then the tabernacle's up ready for business. You know, all three of these represent areas of our lives. All of us have bitterness, because as Messiah said, in this world you will have troubles. Be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. But you'll still have troubles here. Anybody here without any troubles? Never sick? Never tired, never short of some money, never short of time. Your job is just a joy to go to every day. And when you come home, it's such a joy to come home to your wife and family, your parents, whoever it may be. Your house is absolutely perfect, and your grass just kind of cuts itself. I mean, you know, it's just, we all have troubles. We all have troubles. And you know, there's a part of us, and our job is the sockets and the pillars. This is the heaviest part of the tabernacle. It's the earthy part. It's where we have to come into contact and plant ourselves in this world. We are part of this world. The Bible never tells us to be isolated. It says, come out and be separate, but does not say, come out and be isolated. Only when we're separate can we really have an impact in this world. Being isolated, you're pretty much good for nothing. So we are to be a part of this world. We have physical bodies. We are to invest our time and energies being lights in this world, living lives, being productive, being examples of what well-adjusted, healthy, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally, what healthy, well-adjusted people should be like. We should live full lives. We should choose life in everything we do. But there's troubles. But the world's watching. How do you deal with the troubles? But there's a part of us also that's a stranger here. You know, the older I get, on the one hand, this body kind of becomes more comfortable because I'm more used to it. It's like old clothes. It's a little threadbare, but it's well broken in, a little beat up around the edges, but it's comfortable. It's like that pair of jeans you put on after you get home from work. You just put on your comfortable clothes, your comfortable shoes, and that comfortable sweatshirt, and you just feel comfortable. That's how your body kind of gets. But by the same token, spiritually, I'm less and less at home in this world. There's more of a homesickness to be home in the body than what I inhabit for eternity. and to be in the home that God's built for me and is building for me, and to spend time in a place where there's no sickness, no death, no tears, no sleep even. You don't even have to sleep. And I'm homesick for that. So this flesh, though I carry it around, you know, and I live in it, and I guess I'll live in it for a while longer, I'm a stranger here. This is just my earth suit temporarily. And when I shed that, I'm no longer a part of this world. And to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. I want to be present with the Lord. And every day that passes, I'm more ready for that. But then there's the part of each of us that's like Kohath, called out, entirely otherworldly. The part that is in charge of the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, the menorah, the places where only the initiated and only the high priest goes, the place of intimate fellowship with God, the most internal, deepest part of yourselves that is really not of this world. In fact, some very, very serious warnings are given to the members of Kohath not to gaze on these things. You carry them around, and Aaron, he'll come in there, and he'll cover the Ark of the Covenant, but don't you dare start looking under that to get a gaze at the Ark of the Covenant. You carry it around, but it is so holy and so intimate, you treat it with great respect. There's a part of every one of us that is a Holy of Holies. There's a part of every one of us that if you know God, if you're serving Him, His Shekinah dwells there with you. And it's a holy thing. We have this treasure in earthly jars of clay, these earthen vessels, right? And so there's a holy aspect to us. And don't ever, ever diminish that at all. Every one of you is a tabernacle of God's very Spirit. And that's an amazing thing. So all three of these families are a picture of every one of us. They're all pictures of us. And we all have work to do. As you read through chapter 4, it keeps referring to the avodah, the work, the avod, the work, the work, the work they are to do. And some English translations even use the word yoke a few places in this chapter. Which got me to thinking, all of us have a work to do. And it's so nice, you know, if you're a member of Levi, then your work is spelled out for you. You know exactly what your work is. There's no question about it. But so many times we can spend years in this world and not be quite certain what we're supposed to be doing here anyway. And I remember for years there, I'd be praying and thinking, God, what is the work you give me to do? And I'm always looking out on the horizon. What's this big thing you want me to accomplish for you? You know, he never has shown me what that is. But then again, I quit asking. Because instead of looking for the big thing out there, I began to discover the yoke. You see, when you put on God's yoke, it's no longer up to you to figure out what the big thing is. Your only job is to walk where the yoke master directs you and plod along one step at a time. But you see, I'm always want to look back and see what I've accomplished. Picture yourself in a yoke. There's a yoke. And you're in there, you're yoked with Yeshua, but every 10 or 15 steps, you want to turn around and look and see what you've accomplished. You know what you're going to do if you keep turning around? You're not going to accomplish much of anything. And what you do accomplish is going to be pretty faulty. You won't see what has been accomplished until you come to the end of the task. But what we are commanded to do is to take the yoke upon us. Now, we're all familiar with the passage in Matthew, chapter 11, verses 28 to 30, where Messiah says, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you work." Is that what he says? "I will give you rest." You know, one of our philosophies here at Beth Tikkun is if you come to Beth Tikkun, we are not going to strap you with a job or a responsibility. Unless it's working in the nursery, of course. That's an exception. But we're not going to right away try to trap you into being a part of Beth Tikkun by giving you some responsibility. In many congregations, though, that is exactly what they do try to do. They want you to stay put, so they're going to put a responsibility on you so you can't leave. My philosophy is this. Let's do what Yeshua says. You come here, many people come to Beth Tikkun. They've come from congregations where they've been burned, been beat up, been disillusioned, been hurt. So we just tell people, just come and rest. Just come, relax. And after you're rested up, and when you feel like it, when you're ready, then there's things to do. But right now we want you to rest first and then work out of that rest. Okay? And that's how Yeshua is. And that's what I want this congregation to reflect. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. If the yoke you have on is not easy, and if the burden you're pulling is not light, I have news for you. It's not Yeshua's yoke, and it's not Yeshua's burden. You may be told that it is, you may think that it is, and it may look like it is, but it ain't. It just ain't, okay? Because his yoke is easy. His burden is light. Now, too often we view the yoke itself as the burden. The yoke is not the burden. The yoke serves two purposes. One is, it's to double the strength of the animal. It takes two animals and puts them together, and it harnesses their strength together. And since Yeshua says, take my yoke upon you, then we know that we're sharing a yoke with him. All right? So there are two together here. That means each one does half the work. But I'm going to let you know a secret. If you're yoked to Yeshua, he's doing most of the work. All right? Looking on, people might think you're doing half. You ain't. All right? And the purpose of the yoke is there he says, is to learn from me. For I'm gentle, humble in heart. And he says, my yoke is easy. It's comfortable. It fits well. It's a natural fit. Yeshua is a carpenter. He built houses, and I'm sure he built yokes too. He's also the creator. You can't have a better deal than that. The same one who made the ox is the same one who's in the wood shop making the yoke for that ox. You can't ask for a better fit. And so Yeshua, because the word tells us Messiah is the creator of the world. And that's not Christian theology, that's sound Jewish theology. The Messiah is the creator. He made you. You're his idea. And so if he has a yoke for you to wear, guess what? It's going to be a perfect fit. It's going to be comfortable. It's going to be something made for you, and you're made for it. You can't do better than that. But the second thing a yoke does, first of all, it keeps you in proper relationship with another creature. The second thing it does, though, it attaches you to the work that you are to do. Whether that's pulling a carriage full of people or a wagon full of wood or pulling a plow, that's up to the one who owns you. And you know what? You don't even have to look back to see what you're pulling. All you got to do is just keep walking. But he guarantees you that his burden is light. His burden's light. It's not going to kill you. It's not going to wear you down. Now, you notice the words here in caps, you will find rest for your souls. Did you know that that's a quote that Yeshua is actually quoting Jeremiah? How many knew that? Two people knew. Well, good. You're all going to learn something today. Now, here's what I want you to notice he's quoting. You ready? It's Jeremiah 6:16. Look what it says there. Thus says the Lord, stand by the ways and see and ask for the ancient paths where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it. You see, when Yeshua used that phrase, you'll find rest for your souls, he was not saying, I've got some new yoke for you. He's saying, my yoke is the ancient ways. My yoke is the Torah. You know, when you read Jewish literature, you find the phrase yoke of Torah many, 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 many times. This was not a new phrase that Yeshua coined. It was an ancient phrase when he first used it, and it's a phrase that's used by Jewish writers today. And all through Jewish history, the Torah has been seen as a yoke. It's a thing that does two things. It brings us in proper relationship with God and allows us to accomplish our life's work. That's its purpose. It brings us in proper relationship with God and it equips us to accomplish our life's work. And Yeshua is purposely alluding to this passage in Jeremiah 6. Jeremiah 6, which says to go back to see and to ask for the ancient ways. So, what have we learned about the yoke? It keeps two together. By obeying the Torah, and how do you put a yoke on? You put your head into it. You don't put your leg in it. You don't put your arm. You put your head into it. So you take the Torah and you put your head into it. You got it? Put your head in the Torah. It should fill your mind. That's why in the Shema it says you're to talk about these things. When you lie down, when you rise up, when you walk in the way, when you sit in your home, you're teaching your children, you talk about the Torah. It's just constantly. What's in your mind is coming out and it's going in your ears and you're always digesting and always talking Torah all the time. Yeah, Robert. Yes, it was, because, yes. Yes. Rabbis have distinct takes on what the Torah is and how it's to be lived out. And so when you take your rabbi's yoke, it means you're seeing Torah the way he sees it. And you're going to live out Torah the way he sees it. And this is why we have various Hasidic groups. We have the Satmars and the Lubavitchers and all these different ones. And they all see Torah a little bit differently. Mostly the same, but their differences are pronounced enough to where they have their own communities. And so, although they each think they're living out Torah, but they realize we're living out Torah according to the traditions of our group, our fathers, this particular community that we're in. So Yeshua comes along, and he says, now don't even think I came to destroy the Torah. Now why would anybody even think he came to destroy the Torah? It's because his take on Torah was revolutionary. He's basically saying everybody's got it a bit right and everybody's got it a bit wrong. And, wrong overhead. And so he said, don't come think that I came to destroy the Torah or the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to fill. Fill means to properly interpret, to properly live out. And what's interesting is that we were talking about this on Shavuot. Did Yeshua ease the commandments of Torah, or did he reinforce and elevate the commandments of Torah? Did he make them easier to keep or more difficult to keep? Ken? Well, actually, it's both. What he did, he took all the additions that the Pharisees had added to the Torah, all these traditions that had been taught as commandments. He brought those back down to balance where the Torah is, because you're not to add to the Torah. And, you know, Yeshua would talk about the Pharisees, how they'll bind heavy burdens on men's shoulders. Got that? Heavy burdens, not light burdens. Heavy burdens, because they add all these extra commandments on. They teach for commandments the traditions of men, and that is wrong. And Yeshua says, but they want one little finger to help alleviate that burden they put on your shoulders. So Yeshua eased that. He brought Torah back down to where it's supposed to be, the commandments of Torah, nothing more. But when it came to the internal life, the thought life, the motives, he raised the bar. And he says, you know, for it says, thou shalt not kill. I say to you, don't be angry with your brother without a cause. Because that's like murder in your mind. The Torah says, don't commit adultery. He says, I say, you don't look after a woman to lust after her. You commit adultery with her already in your heart. Look how he's raising the standard when it comes to the internal. When it comes to the thought life and the motives, he raises the way up. When it comes to the physical, he brings it right back down to ground zero, where the Torah is at. He eases that burden back to where it's supposed to be. He doesn't undo one single commandment of Torah. He does not negate any of the commandments. But he completely erases all the man-made traditions that have been turned into commandments and brings it back down to pure Torah. But the internal life, thought life, the life of motives, he brings that right up to where the internal and external are brought into perfect balance. As I was looking in Hebrew, I knew one of the words for yoke, the most common word, but I found there are four words used in the Hebrew Bible for yoke. And I'm going to bring them out in alphabetical order. And there's a real lesson to be learned from these. I don't want to take too much time on them, but they're really worth looking at. The first word is mot, or mota. And the root is to totter back and forth. And you might picture someone, because people sometimes wear yokes, like with a stick out, and they'll hang pails of milk or water. And when they walk, what happens to these pails? They swing back and forth. And that's what the word mota means. Interesting thing more about the word mot. It's a homophone for another word, which sounds the same, but is spelled differently, and it means death. There are two letters in Hebrew that have the sound of T, the letter T. One is the tet here, and the other is the tav. And if you replace the tet with a tav, the word becomes death. And you know, there's a lesson there for us. Before you take Yeshua's yoke on you, you have to die to your own. Doesn't Yeshua say, if any man will come after me, must first deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me? All through our lives, you make choices. And whatever you say yes to means you have to say no to something else. You have to die to something else. All right? If you choose this particular woman or this particular man as your spouse, that means you're dying to all the others. They're no longer even under consideration. So before you say yes to this one, you better make sure you're ready to say no to all the others. And we can apply this to any decision we make. So death is an important part about putting on the yoke of Messiah. I apologize for the handwriting there. But death. There's another word for yoke. It's the word manor. Not manure, manor. And it means to break up ground. So this is definitely a yoke that's used to pull a plow, manor. And it comes from the word near. Now those Hebrew students of mine may know what the word near means. It has two meanings. The exact same word has two meanings. One word is lamp, and one is to break up ground. One is a noun and one is a verb. Same pronunciation, same exact spelling, even the same vowel pointings. Near. Think about that for a second. Near can be a lamp, or near can be breaking up ground, plowing ground. From the word near lamp, we get the word menorah, which is a multi-branched lamp. And from the near break up ground, we get the word menor, yoke. Isn't Hebrew incredible? Who would ever think of connecting a yoke with a menorah? But to turn menorah into menorah, all you do is add the letter he, the letter of breath, just breathing out. And that yoke becomes a lamp, becomes a menorah. Is your work light? When you are yoked to the light of the world, everything you do produces light. And sometimes it feels like you're just plodding around in a muddy old field with a piece of wood chained to your neck, out in the hot sun. But in the spiritual realm, you're being light. Menor and menorah. Remember those two words. And when you think you're being light, you can do it without doing any work. Well, you're just deceiving yourself. Your menorah better have menorah behind it, work. Better have a yoke. And your yoke should be producing light. Because they go together. Yes, Dale.
I see your menorah as yoking one side of spiritual revelation for the other side and maintaining the balance.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? The picture of the yoke. A menorah has to have balance. That's the purpose of a yoke. Balance between two. Yep. See, in the physical realm, a yoke and a menorah don't seem to have anything in common. In the spiritual realm, you can't.
They're identical.
Yeah, they're identical. Because your work should be light. Your light should be work. Maybe this is what Messiah had in mind when he says, let your light so shine among men that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Yeshua saw the connection between light and work, between menorah and menorah. So, we see here that with a second word, that our lives and our works should be light in this world. But you have to die first before you can be light. The third word that's used in the Hebrew Bible is the word ol, O-L, ol. It's from the word all. Notice they're spelled exactly the same, just pronounced differently. All means upon. Just like you put a yoke upon the shoulders or upon the necks of a team of oxen. And from the word ol, we get the word Belial, Belial. Several places in the Bible, the sons of Belial are referred to. Belial means without a yoke. And the sons of Belial are always bad. They're always bad guys. And I just put a couple references down. Deuteronomy 13:13 refers to sons of Belial coming and bringing false prophecies and leading people away from the Torah. But there's one place in the New Testament where Belial is referred to. 2 Corinthians 6:15, which states, it's actually a question. 2 Corinthians 6:15, Paul asks the question, what harmony has Messiah with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? What's so confusing is that it's taught in so many communities, churches, and so on, that to be yoked to Messiah means to throw out the Torah. Isn't that confusing? You're supposed to put on Messiah's yoke, and yet you're supposed to be without a yoke of Torah. And that makes you a son of Belial. Is it any wonder that so many people who call themselves believers live as sons of Belial? They live such worldly lives, and yet they go around claiming to be witnesses for Christ. No wonder there's so much confusion. They have not gone back to the ancient ways to find rest of their souls. And God says, turn back to the ancient ways, to the ancient paths, and walk in them. You'll find rest of your souls. And they said, we will not. Anyways, I could start preaching. I'm not going to do that. Another interesting word that comes from the word all is the word olah. In the first chapter of Leviticus, remember we're talking about the olah? What's an olah? An offering. An olah is whatever goes up. And we are to be living sacrifices. So when we take Messiah's yoke upon us, we first have to die to our own desires, our own way of doing things. And as we do his work, we become light. And guess what? The next thing is we become offerings. We become offerings. We become an olah as we go up into his presence, living sacrifices. But there's one more word, a fourth word, zemed. Zemed can mean two animals joined together or the amount of ground a yoke of oxen can plow in one day. Some places the word zemed is translated acre, an acre. An acre to them is whatever a team of oxen could plow in one day. That's an acre, and they measure land that way. But the word zemed has more to do with the joining process. And in Numbers 25, verses 3 and 5, Israel is said to be zemed with Baal Peor. They have yoked themselves together with a false god. So zemed has in mind the two brought together as one, but also it has in mind the work that has been accomplished. Because even an amount of ground can be called a zemed, because that's how much two oxen can plow in a day. So here we see work accomplished. This is when we can look back, we can stop and rest and say, wow, we did all of that together. And Paul talks about how someday we'll stand before the Lord and each man will receive praise from God. Think about that for a second. That just blows my mind. Yes, Phil. Yes. Right. That's a good point. Yes. Let's say you have an ox. I mean, you bring up such a great point. Say you have an ox. You have all this potential, this power, and this strength. I remember reading a book about the pioneers crossing North America to get out west. And when they got about a little over past the Appalachian Mountains, they traded in their horses for oxen. Because the horses just couldn't do the work. An ox would just keep on walking and walking and walking. In fact, an ox doesn't even get tired. It finally just dies. You have to make it rest. It'll just die until you make it stop. But the horses couldn't do it. It'd kill the horses. The oxen would just keep going and going like they ever already done. Basically, it would stop. So let's say you have this powerful ox here. How in the world do you get any work out of it? How do you get any useful work out of it? Only one answer. A yoke. That's the only way to take the potential of that animal and harness it to accomplish something. So here we are. Here's a world full of people made in God's image. And there's God. He's our creator. He has desires for us, righteous desires. We have desires for ourselves, often righteous desires. Or at least they're maybe not righteous, but we fool ourselves into thinking they are. But there's this hunger and thirst to do something purposeful with our lives. So here's God knows exactly what we need to do to make us fulfilled and make life the best it can be. Because we're created for good works in Messiah Yeshua. And here we are, ready to do something with our lives. What do we do? How is it harnessed? Here's the yoke. When you put this on, then guess what? Your mind is brought into alignment with God's. Your efforts are brought into alignment with His. Your goals are brought into alignment with His. And pretty soon, you're living a life parallel to His. And it's fulfilling. But remember, Yeshua's yoke is easy. His burden is light. And there are some people, and in the Messianic movement, as well as every other denomination, who delight themselves and pride themselves in making the yoke difficult and the burden heavy. Because let's face it, you know, if you and I are walking your yoke to Yeshua over there, and I'm yoke to Yeshua over here, how's it going over there, Phil? Oh, man, this is tough work, but I'm just keeping at it. It is hard, 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 hard. And I'll start thinking, wow, mine's pretty easy. Maybe I'm not doing much. You see, we can boast when our yoke is difficult and our burden is heavy. The thing is, I don't care. I don't want to boast it. I want the yoke that Yeshua's made. You see what I'm saying? So a lot of people take pride in adding all this other junk in that's not part of God's idea.
You talk like the guy all the time.
I have to get my Yosemite Sam hat out. I only use that voice at home with Robin, actually. All right.
Fine. Actually, they have to teach them as calves to be in the yoke. And they have to learn this different sounds to make them go one direction in another direction. And they have to learn to be in that yoke together.
Yeah.
They have to be taught.
Yep, so we have to be born again. We have to start it all new, don't we?
Right.
Yes, good point. Good point. Doesn't come naturally. Well, let's talk about some unbearable yokes here. Here we go. Unbearable yokes. Now, you could put a whole host of unbearable yokes up here, but the apostolic scriptures talk primarily about two unbearable yokes, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. They were always butting heads with one another, but the only thing they came into agreement on is with this Yeshua guy. And but we see the term Sadducees and Pharisees throughout the apostolic scriptures, but many people don't understand who these two groups are, what they represent. So let's take a look. The Sadducees were by far the smaller group. They rejected all tradition, Jewish traditions, they're gone. They rejected the resurrection. They did not believe in a resurrection. They did not believe the prophets and the writings. Now remember, the Old Testament, the Tanakh, is divided into three sections. The Torah, the Nevi'im, which are the prophets, and the Chatuvim, which are the writings, Psalms, Proverbs, so on. This is where we get the word Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Chatuvim. This is the same division that Messiah recognized when he met the disciples on the road from Emmaus, and he says, beginning with Moses, which is a code word for the Torah, and the prophets, and the Psalms. Many times the writings were just referred to as the Psalms, because Psalms is the largest of the writings, and it's the first book of the Ketuvim. So the Sadducees, they accepted the Torah, the five books of Moses. The rest of it, nope, don't want to study it, don't want to hear about it, it's not God's word. They did not believe in future reward or punishment. I mean, there's no resurrection, there's no afterlife, there's no reward and punishment. What they did embrace was free will, total free will. They rejected God's sovereignty, self-determinism, making it my way. And since they didn't believe in an afterlife, they put all their investment into this life. And so as a result, they're pretty rich, most of them. Because after all, if this is all there is, let's make the most of it. So they were very affluent, they were rich. And predominantly, the priests were Sadducees for whatever reason. So when you read about the priest in the New Testament, most likely they are the Sadducees. The Pharisees, on the other hand, the Pharisees are the ones from whom the Hasidics descend. The Lubavitchers and the Satmars and there's a whole bunch of them. The Hasidic groups, the long, you know, curls over their ears and the black clothing. They descend from the Pharisees. Paul was a Pharisee. He was a Pharisee his whole life, till the day he died. When he was on trial, he even referred to himself, I am a Pharisee. He didn't say, I was a Pharisee, I am a Pharisee. And we, most likely, as we look at Yeshua's teachings, Yeshua was a Pharisee as well. So quit thinking of a Pharisee as a hypocrite. All right? Don't think of a Pharisee as a hypocrite. Many of the Pharisees and Sadducees of Yeshua's day were leaders in the Jewish community, and they were, yes, hypocrites. But to say Pharisee means hypocrite, no. Can't do that. Once again, Yeshua's teachings tend to line up more with the Pharisees. Where he really parted ways with them was when they took traditions and elevated them to commandments. There he wouldn't go. But they did believe in traditions. Yeshua did too. Just don't teach them his commandments. Pharisees believe in an oral Torah. They believe that the oral Torah was equal to the Torah. Now let me explain what that means. They believe that when God gave the Torah to Moses, he gave it two halves. The written part, which he wrote down and we have in our Bibles, and then an oral part that was not written down, was handed down from generation to generation orally, which contained all the extra commandments like, don't flip light switches on Shabbat. Don't eat meat and dairy together. You know, if you flick a mosquito off your hand on the Shabbat and it goes out the window, if it goes more than 18 inches, you've done work and you have to bring a sin offering. If it's less than 18 inches, you're all right. I mean, this is all part of the oral Torah. Everything in the Talmud, they believe, is equal to the Torah. In fact, when you talk to a civic person and you say, what you been doing? Oh, I've been studying Torah all day. They haven't been studying the Bible. They've been studying the Talmud. Okay? So, yes, Phil. Yeah, just of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh yeah. Exactly. Yep.
So those Pharisees were, I guess in our modern teachings were, Pharisees are normally represented always as a bad.
Yes, because, yeah, the reputation. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And a number of the Sadducees and Pharisees became believers in Acts. And they were still Pharisees. I think the Sadducees probably had a hard time because they kind of had to accept that Yeshua did rise from the dead. So they kind of have to revamp the whole no resurrection thing. No resurrection? Because the resurrection is never mentioned in the Torah. The resurrection itself is not mentioned in the Torah. So since it's not mentioned in the Torah, they didn't believe it. So, yeah. There's a whole lot more we can say about this, but it's hard to believe how someone could be a Sadducee and be very happy. Maybe that's why they're called... Oh, they're not Sadducees. The Sadducees are ones who wash the clothes for the Sadducees. This should be... That's why they were sad, you see. All right. Anyways. Exactly. No, they didn't believe in any afterlife whatsoever. You tell me. That's probably why there weren't too many of them. They were the smaller group. The only thing I can think of is this. I know I'm being kind of silly, but the point is this. If there's no afterlife, it excuses me to go after everything I can in this life. Position, money, wealth, everything in this life. Not exactly. Paganism believes in many gods, but... Oh, yeah, sure. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Yes, question here. Yes, that's a pretty widespread belief in Hasidic Judaism, that when you go to hell, it's only for a 12-month stint, at the most. Yeah, I don't know where they get it, but 12 months. Yeah. Yes, Dale.
If I were a Sadducee, I'd have a hard time getting past Enoch walking with God.
Yeah. And, of course, how did Yeshua, when the Sadducees challenged him about, okay, there's a man... A woman who is married, her husband dies, so she marries his brother, he dies, she marries the third brother, and then there were seven in all, and there's all seven brothers, and then she dies. So whose husband is she in heaven? Of course, they're trying to say, look how ridiculous this whole resurrection thing is. Well, Yeshua answers their question, and he says, I got a question for you. God calls himself, and of course he goes back to the Torah, since it's all they accept, that's what Yeshua uses them. He says, God calls himself the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yet the Torah tells us he's the God of the living, not of the dead. Therefore, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob must be alive. And then it says, after that, they didn't ask him any more questions. So. Right.
So, you did the first sentence in the Torah, and the fourth section, you see what comes and he goes to heaven and he's back. Mm-hmm. And you broke the words out of him.
No. I must not have been listening to that.
Yeah. You did the first sentence of the Bible in Hebrew.
Yes, okay.
And you broke it into three seven.
Okay.
And the fourth word
Aleph Tov.
then he goes to heaven and comes back. That's
pure that's a picture. It's a hint of something. See, under the surface we find these hints, though they're not spelled out directly. No, remember the Hasidics today are Pharisees. They do believe in the resurrection, so they find all kinds of allusions to the resurrection in the Torah. But to be specifically spelled out in the Peshat, in the surface of the Torah, it's not there. It just isn't there. The Karaites basically are Sadducees. Yeah, the Karaites basically today are the Sadducees. A few differences, but mostly they're Sadducees in practice. Okay. Boy, I see hands up everywhere. Ken. A Pharisee, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Bonnie. Yes. Mm-hmm. They were Pharisees. Yeah. Yes.
And he got into an argument with the Pharisees in the temple, and he swore that all the Maccabeans after them were all going to be Sadducees. But they could see the eye of mine.
Wow.
That's quite interesting. Yeah. And all Pharisees were John and Penis.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, they'll find out why they did that. Yeah. Okay, shall we move on? Oh, Phil has his finger there. Yeah, the Torah, the five books of Torah. Yeah, after they end the Deuteronomy, there's nothing else worth reading in their minds. Yes. Now, the characteristics of the Pharisees are very legalistic. Whereas you could say the Sadducees took away from God's word, the Pharisees added to God's word. They took all these traditions and elevated them to commandments. And they challenge Yeshua. Why is it that your disciples set aside the traditions of the fathers? And Yeshua says, well, why do you set aside the commandments of the Torah to keep the traditions of your fathers? And he was always butting heads with these folks. And the Pharisees were poor because they saw themselves investing in the world to come, not in this world. And so they were trying to keep the mitzvot as much as they could and giving money away and studying the Torah and the prophets and the writings. And they didn't pursue wealth the way the Sadducees did. So you can imagine what it was like in the temple. The priests are mostly all Sadducees. And they're in there doing the work of the temple. And the Pharisees come in to watch everything they do with an eagle eye and to criticize them on everything they did. You're not doing it the way the Torah says. And it was just not a happy place. So they were always going at it. But the main thing I want you to remember about the Pharisees is that they believed the oral Torah, these oral traditions that they believed God gave Moses. There's no indication that he necessarily gave them hints, but it's all written down in the Mishnah and the Gemara, the Talmud. They believe the oral Torah is Torah. When you talk to a Hasid today, they'll say, yeah, God's word is a two-edged sword. Written Torah, oral Torah. And that's what they studied, the oral Torah. Now with that in mind, let's get back to the word yoke. Go to Acts chapter 15. And many of you know where I'm going with this discussion, but this is a very important one, very important for us as Messianic believers. In Acts 15, you've got this council in Jerusalem where they're trying to figure out, what do we do with all these Gentiles who are coming to faith in our Jewish Messiah? Up until this point, the believers are all Jews. And then there's Samaritans who are half Jews, and they're like, well, we don't like that, but hey, God accepted them, what can we say? But when the Gentiles, God pours out the Spirit on the Gentiles, like, what do we do with them? They're not even trying to keep the Torah. They're not circumcised. They're not even kosher. And what do we do with them? They believe in the Messiah, but they don't know anything about Torah. Look what it says. In Acts 15:5, this is very important. It says, but some of the sect of the Pharisees who had believed, some of the Pharisees who had now become believers in Yeshua as their risen Messiah, stood up saying, it is necessary to circumcise them, the Gentiles, and to direct them to observe the Torah of Moses. So they discussed this. This is a long discussion. Then you go down to verse 10. Peter stands up. He's at the council. What does Peter say? Now therefore, why do you put God to the test by placing upon the neck of the disciples a yoke which neither our fathers nor we have been able to bear? Sounds like Peter's anti-Torah, doesn't it? Pharisees say, Gentiles keep the Torah. Peter says, what in the world do you want to put that terrible, heavy burden on their necks? We couldn't keep it. Our fathers couldn't keep it. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Why do you want to think the Gentiles should try to keep it? But you see, there's an important principle here. If you do not read the word in its context, you will read it out of context, and you will derive the wrong meaning. The writer of Acts, who is Luke, as far as we can tell, was very specific to tell us that some of the sect of the Pharisees who had believed stood up saying it's necessary to circumcise Gentiles and direct them to observe the Torah of Moses. What is the Torah of Moses to a Pharisee? It is the oral Torah as well as the Torah. It's all the stuff about not mixing meat and dairy. It's all the stuff about not flicking flies off your hand and them going out the window more than 18 inches on the Shabbat. It's all this extra stuff. If a chicken lays an egg on the Sabbath, are you allowed to eat it? And their answer is, it depends. It says in the Talmud, it depends. If the Sabbath, if the chicken laid the egg for reproductive purposes, you can eat the egg. But if the chicken laid the egg in order for the egg to be eaten, you can't eat the egg. That's my question. And if, are you allowed to pick up a rock on the Sabbath? No, you may not pick up a rock on the Sabbath. Can you pick up your little child on the Sabbath? Yes, you may pick up your little child on the Sabbath. What if my child's holding a rock? Yes, you can pick the child, the child's holding a rock, but you can't pick up the rock without the child holding the rock. And it goes on and 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 on. No end to this. It's a heavy burden that disciples say, we couldn't keep it, our fathers couldn't keep it. But remember who is saying to keep the Torah of Moses? Pharisees. And what do the Pharisees believe the Torah of Moses is? The written Torah and all the extra additions of the oral Torah. Even though the Torah itself specifically states, do not add to the Torah, do not take away from the Torah. Of course, the Pharisee says, well, this is the Torah. The Talmud is the Torah. I mean, I can go on and on and on giving you all kinds of crazy examples of the commandments that are found in the Talmud. Go ahead, Paul, you get your hands up. Well, great question. How do we know they're not throwing out the Torah as well? Okay. That's a great question. Thanks, Paul. Glad you're here. No wonder you're a doctor. All right. Acts 15. They just tried to figure out, what do we do with these Gentiles? They said, well, we'll give them four necessary commandments. And these commandments are repeated several times. And so let's read what they are. Verse 19. Therefore, it is my judgment. Now, James is speaking here. The brother of Messiah, who is like the head of the redeemed community in those days in Jerusalem. It is my judgment that we do not trouble those who are turning to God from among the Gentiles, but that we write to them that they abstain from, first of all, things contaminated by idols, food contaminated by idols. Second, fornication. Third, traith. See, it says here, what is strangled. This is a way of referring to traith. Traith is a Hebrew word that means torn. And in the Torah, back in Leviticus, we studied this. If you find an animal that has died from being torn by a wild animal, it's called traith because it's been torn. You're not allowed to eat it. That word traith came to be applied to any kind of meat you're not allowed to eat, whether it's been torn or died of disease and natural causes, or whether it's a pig or whether it's an oyster or whatever it is. It just all came to be called torn, traith. And how does it that an animal tears another animal? An animal kills another animal by going for the neck, strangling it, right? It's instinct. If an animal wants to kill another animal, it goes for the neck, clamps down, cuts off the air until the animal dies. and they eat it. So referring from abstain from things strangled simply refers treif. And then from blood, don't eat blood. So you have two definite dietary laws, treif and eating blood, because the Bible's very strict about not eating blood. Stay away from fornication. And then it says the pollutions of idols. In other words, all kinds of idolatry, including food that's been dedicated to an idol. Where did they get these four commandments? From the Torah. Why these four? Go to the next verse, verse 21. For Moses, or the Torah, Moses is a key word for Torah. For Moses from ancient generations has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogues every Sabbath. So, here are four basic commandments. You keep these four, you'll be welcomed into the synagogue. Now, it doesn't say they can go into the temple. They'll still be ritually impure. All right, so Gentiles can't go into the temple. There's a sign over the Mekitza that says, you're a Gentile, and you come in through this door, we find you, you will die. Gentiles are not allowed in here. But they were allowed to go into the synagogue. Ritual purity was not necessary for the weekly synagogue services in every city. So in other words, Gentiles, start with these four commandments. These are starting points. And if you obey these four, you can attend the synagogue, and you can study the Torah. You can learn the Torah. You can learn how to live this redeemed life. So the purpose is, yes, we want them to know the Torah. That's the yoke. That's how you bring your life in alignment with God. But the world Torah? No. Not the Pharisaical definition of Torah. The Torah definition of Torah. Yeah, Ken.
In this call, I've heard people say this, even then, and that's all that they have. You know, if they progress.
So they can steal and kill and commit adultery and not tithe and everything else, yeah. That's ridiculous. No. I know. See, I used to teach this back years ago before I knew anything about Torah. And I talk to, see how easy it is for us? These are only four commandments. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, this is stupid. Why are these four? Why are these so important? I guess I never read verse 21. It must not have been in my Bible.
It even says Sabbath in the end.
Absolutely. On every Sabbath. So, it's just so funny when you begin to see God's word more clearly. It just, these things just emerge out of it. It's just plain as day. I'm sorry, Phil, you had your hand up too. This was after. The sheet is in verse 10, or chapter 10, Acts 10. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. The sheet of animals had nothing to do with food.
Right.
Yeah.
But it reinforces that.
Exactly. You know, very good observation.
That later in Acts, I mean, that just reinforces that. That's
yes. Right.
That's verse 7. Peter talked about that. Verse 7. He's making reference to the sheet. And 15. Is that right?
Okay, I'm sorry. I was...
Verse 7 says, Peter, after the discussion, Peter got up and addressed them, brothers, you know that some time ago God made a choice among you that the Gentiles might hear from my lips the message of the gospel and believe.
Yes.
That's chapter 10.
Yes. The Cornelius song. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, our time is gone. So we'll close with this one verse. You know, Peter talks about, it's people who want to believe that Peter's referring to the written Torah as being such a heavy yoke that we can't bear it. Just remember what 1 John 5:3 says. Here's John. He says, now this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. Didn't Yeshua say, if you love me, you will keep my commandments? And his commandments are not burdensome. So, did John and Peter just not see the eye to eye? Was Peter saying that the Torah is burdensome? Then John says, oh, no, it's not. Yes, it is. Oh, no, it's not. I don't think so. See, there's no conflict here. The Torah that John is talking about is not the Torah of the Pharisees. It's not all the oral traditions. All the things that Yeshua argued about with them, washing hands and all these other things they had elevated to commandments. So, the commandments of God are not burdensome. Because Yeshua says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. And you know, as I can speak for Robin as well, as our family has begun to build God's mitzvot, just commandments of our lives, what a joy they are. What a delight they are. And they just bring order and purpose and light and structure to our activities, for our schedules. And it's just a joy to keep. They really are. And the yoke I was wearing before I discovered Torah, that I was bragging about being so light and easy, turned out to be really a hard one to wear, because it was not Yeshua's yoke. And I found the yoke of Torah is the easiest yoke I've ever had to wear. And his burden is the lightest burden I've ever had to bear. But back in the days I used to preach against the heaviness of Torah, I was burdened. I was just dragging around. I was so worn out with living life my way, thinking I was living life God's way. But praise God for his mercy and patience with us. Well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time together. Thank you for your word that is a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. Thank you for your Torah, Father. And Lord, I pray that we would look at the Torah as it is revealed in the life of Yeshua. That is something you've given us as a delight. You've given us as something that, as David describes, is sweeter than honey in the honeycomb. And something to be desired much more than gold, even fine gold. It is precious and it is good. And it points the way of life. And to live the life of Torah out of love for you is to live the life of Yeshua. So Lord, help us to bring our lives more in alignment with yours. To bring our minds more in alignment with your mind and our ways with your ways. So that we can accomplish our life's work together. So Father, I thank you for the contentment and the joy there is in serving you. Help us to serve you in your way. And we'll give you the praise and the glory for it in the precious name of Yeshua, our teacher, our Messiah. Amen.